Thank you. Be seated. Good morning. Course orders are herein pronounced and are posted outside and in the clerk's office. This morning we have three causes that will be presented, submitted by oral argument. In the order of their presentation, they are Texas Association of Business versus the Texas Air Control Board and others, a direct appeal. Caller Times Publishing Company, Incorporated versus Triad Communications, Incorporated from Nueces County. And May versus United Services Association of America and others from Rusk County. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments, but we will finish all three before lunch. Counsel in the second and third causes may leave the courtroom before your argument, but please be close by so that we may proceed to your matters without delay. These arguments are being tape recorded for the convenience of the court. You may make application to hear those tapes with the clerk. There's a video being made of portions of the first cause, at least, by public news media. In the first cause, we have allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Justice Hightower is recused in this matter, but he will participate in the other causes to be submitted this morning. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from the appellant.
May it please the court, Mr. Douglas Alexander has been arguing for this petition.
May it please the court, Doug Alexander representing the direct appellant in this matter, the Texas Association of Business. I'm joined at council table by my partner, Jim Checkley. Your Honor, this case considers the collision between the right to jury trial embodied in the Texas Bill of Rights and what the appellees have referred to as the administrative state. But before getting to the merits of the argument, I am cognizant of the fact that this court has requested briefing and argument on the issue of standing. That matter has already been fully briefed by both sides, and in fact, the Texas Association of Business and the state independently came to the same conclusion on the standing issue, that is, as to two matters. One, that standing is not a matter of fundamental error and has therefore been waived. And two, even if not waived and therefore proper for consideration, that the pleadings below, under any test that might be applied for standing, were sufficient to establish standing.
And also in Grounds versus Toler, this court said lack of jurisdiction is fundamental error. And applying that to the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, isn't this court obligated to raise the issue of standing?
No, and for this reason, in the Texas Industrial Traffic League and the line of cases that it represents, this court has considered standing to be different than jurisdiction. Without any doubt, jurisdiction is a matter of fundamental error, and as such can be raised at any time, even at oral argument, presumably. Standing, on the other hand, as the court stated in that decision, is not a matter of fundamental error, and it must, to be properly reserved, be raised in the district court by a proper plea and abatement, which here was not done. It was raised initially by special exception. That prompted a repleting addressing the standing issue, and it was never raised again. And so that is the fundamental distinction, is that jurisdiction is fundamental error, but as the court said in the Texas Industrial Traffic League case, standing is not. It is not a matter of fundamental error.
Under the Texas Constitution, a legitimate case in controversy is necessary in order to confer jurisdiction on any of our courts, is it not?
Yes, but again, if the issue is standing,
there can be a case in controversy, legitimate. Two parties can have a billion-dollar battle with each other, and a third person can come in. That's standing, is it not, as opposed to case in controversy?
Well, understand again, and let me express it this way. Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution has a case in controversy requirement. The Texas Constitution, in fact, does not. Standing
issue. But our court has
Has it found one more rigorous than the federal, hasn't it? Pure Facts, lemon juice?
No, it is not more rigorous. No, the I think properly interpreted, the Texas approach on standing is not more rigorous than the federal standard. It has only been adopted at common law and only by implication from other provisions of the Constitution. So I don't think it's appropriate to say that the Texas Constitution is more rigorous than federal. If anything, it should be more relaxed. The exact parameters in the case of associational standing have not been hammered out, but were they to be hammered out, there's no reason to suppose that they would be more exacting. Now, the U.S. Constitution has, or the Supreme Court has hammered out what is meant by associational standing. And it essentially has provided for a test, and the case that really sets it out is the Hunt case, which is in the briefs that we have on standing. And again, what I'm suggesting is what the court held in Texas Industrial Traffic League is it's not a matter of fundamental error, so it should not be reached. But getting to the second part of your concern, even if reached, and whatever standard you might adopt, be that the Hunt standard or another standard, it was met here. And the reason that it was met here is that the pleadings that went unchallenged are more than adequate to establish the standing. In other words,
does the record reflect what percentage of your members have been sanctioned under the regulations that you objected?
The record would only reflect, and I'm hesitating on that. What I'm suggesting to you is this. As part of the pleadings, an exhibit was put in of our members. There's some 3,000 members of the Texas Association of Business. We have before us now the state offered as an appendix to its brief various sanction orders that have come down. And you can do a comparison of the two. And you will see if you do that comparison, and I don't have the exact figures, that in fact a substantial number of this association members have in fact been sanctioned.
How many? 100? Out of 3,000?
Well, I can't tell you. I can tell you that between 1985 and 1986, which is the figure that I started to look at, in that year alone, I want to say that before one agency it was 19, and before the other it was 17, something along that line. I have not done the analysis, that is to say the actual comparison since then, but I would suggest that the number will probably be since 85 on the order of 50 to 100. But that's a guess extrapolating on the year that we looked at, which was the year before this proceeding was filed.
So that's something between 1.5% and 3%.
No. I want to suggest that it's
100
more
would be 3% of 3,000.
Oh, you're talking about the percentage of our members?
Yes.
Yes.
So 1.5 to 3% of your members may have been sanctioned under these regulations. How does your attack upon these regulations and statutes relate to the purpose or function of the Texas Association of Business?
The way it relates to the purpose and function of the Texas Association of Business is that this organization, once again, it's in the pleading, exists for the purpose of protecting, I mean, it's a broad purpose, protecting the interests of its members.
And so when you have standing in this case, you could, for example, challenge the tax laws or the labor laws or workers' compensation laws or virtually any law in this state that affected business.
Only if we meet, again, the other standards which exist for standing. And understand that if you look at the Hunt test, and again, that's the test that's been articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court, and what I'm suggesting again is that it should be no more exacting in Texas. It's not enough to just say that, you know, we have people that are interested. You also have to demonstrate that the action itself is one of which does not require the presence of an individual member. In other words, where the issue is a legal one, which it is here.
Why can't that issue be raised just as well by Goodyear or Firestone or Product Coatings or any of the people who have been sanctioned?
It could be. And there's no, and I'm not going to suggest to you that it could not. What I am going to suggest to you is that the in the situation, such as the test articulated by the Supreme Court, where the presence of Goodyear or Firestone or Texaco is not required, that there is no legitimate reason to say that an association of which they are a member and which they authorize to bring such an action cannot pursue that action. Because again, the question is a legal one, and their actual presence, and that's one of the tests. I mean, it's not without qualification. Their actual presence is not required.
Do you have members who do not agree with your position in this case?
None of which we're aware.
Have you taken a poll?
Well, I think I have to answer that question this way. No, not that I'm aware of, but this association cannot act without the approbation of its members. So, I mean, I cannot answer that question because I do not know, I'm not familiar with the process that was taken to arrive at the decision that this could be prosecuted. But as with any matter that would be done by an association, obviously if the members are opposed to it, it could not be done.
So if you lose this case, then your membership is barred from challenging the constitutionality of these regulations and statutes in any individual proceedings unless they would be involved.
I would say, and this court has not yet had to address that question, but I would say that logically, yes, that would be the result.
And legally,
that would be the result. I say that with a certain amount of trepidation because actually, you know, what we're doing in that case is tying the hands of our members. But if this court is to recognize associational standing as it should, I think logically that has to be the result. In other words, that the bad goes with the good, and that's the bad.
How does this case compare with the city of Richardson versus Responsible Dog Owners of Texas, where this court accepted standing and jurisdiction where some pit bull dog owners were challenging the constitutionality of a city ordinance? Are you familiar with that case?
I confess I'm not. And I apologize. What we did in researching the issue of standing, and we tried to research it exhaustively within the time constraints we have, was to find some case in which this court had squarely addressed the issue, and we found none. This appears to be a matter that this court has not squarely addressed. On the other hand, what we found was that the U.S. Supreme Court has squarely addressed this question on innumerable occasions. There's a whole body of law. And what we were constrained to then do was to analyze the U.S. approach and see whether this state should take a fundamentally different one.
Your time is slipping away. Let me, by question, move you into the merits of the case.
Please do.
Your brief does not cite any cases from outside of Texas, as best I can tell.
That's correct.
Is there any other state, and many states have our identical language on jury trial guarantee, but is there any other state that has essentially taken as strong a position on limiting the power of administrative agencies to define facts as you would propose that this court adopt for our state?
No. None. And let me give you the break.
This issue's been raised over the last 103 years in every state, has it not?
No, it has not, as a matter of fact. And let me give you the scorecard.
It's been raised here in the...
What's that?
It's been raised here in challenges to a number of our early administrative agencies, hasn't it?
Actually, not in the term of administrative agency. It has been raised with respect to the creation of the commission, which is something that I'll address. And let me do this first. Let me give you the scorecard on it. If you look at both sides of the brief, and obviously, and I intend to address this, the U.S. government, the feds, have come down very strongly on this point. I mean, we would lose under the U.S. approach. And what I'm prepared to demonstrate is that our approach in Texas is fundamentally different than the U.S. approach. There are only four states, which have been cited by all the other parties, which have squarely addressed the question here. They are Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Illinois. And they essentially follow lockstep with a federal approach. I mean, we're not talking about a tidal wave of jurisprudence on either side, but there is no doubt of the five entities that have considered it, it's all the other way and not our way. And what I want to do now is demonstrate to you how it is that Texas is fundamentally different on this approach.
Well, the case that you cite, Laredo Credit Bureau, does seem to make heavy emphasis on U.S. Supreme Court authority and on referring to provisions on jury trials in other states in its analysis, doesn't it?
It does.
Why shouldn't we look to the way these other states and the federal courts have interpreted the same constitutional provision?
I think you should look to them. And I think for this reason, when you do look at those, they put in high relief how it is that we're different here. And the difference is this, and I really am restricted on time, so I won't go through the full development of it. But in a nutshell, the difference is this. Texas takes a one-prong approach. It takes a one-prong approach. And that approach is this. Does the right to jury a trial attach to the nature of the action at issue? And that's what Credit Bureau of Laredo is all about. The nature of the action there was precisely indistinguishable from that here. That is, it was an action by the state to recover civil penalties. And because that was the type of action which existed at the time the Constitution was adopted, it was the type of action to which the right to jury trial attached, it was held to attach there. Now, in Texas, unlike the feds, that's the end of the inquiry. That is the end of the inquiry because we have in this state an absolute constraint once the right is found to attach. It's Article 1, Section 29 of the Texas Constitution. And I'll just read it because this is not found in the federal Constitution. It provides provisions of Bill of Rights accepted from powers of government to forever remain inviolate. It says, to guard against transgressions of the high powers herein delegated, we declare that everything in this Bill of Rights is accepted out of the general powers of government and shall ever remain inviolate, and all laws contrary thereto or to the following provisions shall be void. The approach that we take in Texas is a single one. If the right to jury trial is found to attach, and unquestionably here it does, that is the end of the inquiry because at that point the legislature is without power under its general police powers to enact a statute which either impairs or extinguishes that right. Now, how is that different than the U.S. approach? It is different in this way. The U.S. approach, and the case that really highlights it, is a 1989 decision, and it's not cited in the briefs. It's ground, and understand, I might be referring to some cases that aren't in the briefs. We're going to have a transcript prepared of this and submitted as a supplemental brief. Grand Financiera, 492 U.S. 33, 109 S Court, 2782. They outline a three-prong analysis. It is a three-prong analysis. The first is identical to Texas, and that is the nature of the action one to which the right to jury trial attaches at the time the Constitution was adopted. Identical. But then they go on. They said that there are two more questions that need to be asked, and they just have no place in Texas. Here they are. And I'll just go ahead and look at that. The second prong is this. Is the remedy sought legal or equitable? And the reason for that is that under the federal system, as in virtually every state, legal rights get you a jury trial, equitable don't. We don't have that distinction in Texas. We erased it in our Constitution. Article 5, Section 10 erased the distinction between legal and equitable. So that second prong is irrelevant here. The third one, and this is the most important, is this. We then ask, and they say this is the most important analysis, if on balance these two first factors indicate that a party is entitled to a jury, we must decide whether Congress may assign and has assigned resolution of the relevant claim to a non-Article III body without provision for jury trial. What they're saying is, once we find that the right attaches, the next question we have to ask is whether the Congress in the exercise of its police powers can take it away. And the way they do that is by going through, and you'll see it in the Grand Financiera, this bizarre, and I say it's bizarre, it's complex, discussion of whether there are public rights or private rights implicated. And what it finds is if there are public rights implicated, and this is a proper exercise of the police power, then, in fact, the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial gives way. Now, why is that different?
Well, I guess given the limited time that you have, we'll have that case, and you're saying you're going to, what, transcribe these proceedings and file them as a supplement?
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you, with reference to the first note in the Sierra Club brief at page 2 of their brief, whether you concur that the rule that you're asking this court to adopt today would have the effect of declaring or preventing any restriction on jury trials in workers' compensation cases?
I'll tell you the answer to that is I don't know, and I'll tell you why. The reason for that is that the analysis on workers' comp is precisely the same analysis that you have here. And that is that you have to decide in the first instance whether the rights at issue in workers' comp, in this case compensation of employees, were rights for which jury trial was afforded.
And if you assume that to be the case?
Then that's the end of the inquiry. It really is. It's in Texas. And we're stuck with that.
And your clients don't have any quarrel with that position.
Well, let me tell you that I think, very frankly, my clients do have a quarrel with whether the right to jury trial attaches in a workers' compensation case.
Well, let
what
me
I'm telling you is to be intellectually honest. The analysis, we cannot escape what the Texas analysis is.
And well, let me ask you just about this case. As I understand your argument, it is that the fact that there was a common law action for nuisance means that if the legislature codifies various activities which can be prescribed by the state with a fine or a penalty, that has to go to a jury trial.
No.
Okay.
And I see my red light's been on, but if I can answer
Please
the
answer
question.
My question.
Okay. That's close, but that's not it. The reason is that the action at issue here is an action by the state to recover civil penalties. Credit Bureau of Laredo tells us that we look at the nature of the action. And Credit Bureau of Laredo is directly on point. It says that where the action is an action by the state to recover civil penalties, that is a proceeding which, at common law, prior to the adoption of the Constitution, the right to jury trial attached. So it's not really the public nuisance one is a bolstering argument. But the real argument is that this court has already decided in Credit Bureau Laredo, and it's a 9-0 decision by Justice Pope, it has already decided that in proceedings by the state, the right to jury trial attaches, and it's absolute. That's the second point
of
that.
In any time the state seeks civil penalties, that cannot be done through an administrative agency with substantial evidence review.
It cannot be done.
Any time monetary penalties are sought by the state through an agency as opposed to a commission.
No, and let me explain that again. We do not suggest that the state, in this case, is without power in the first instance to assess civil penalties. We're not trying to dismantle the administrative state, as they call it. We are not even suggesting that these statutes, which empower the agencies to, in the first instance, assess civil penalties, cannot continue. The complaint, and you'll see this in Cockrell v. Cox, which is cited in the brief, the complaint is that there is no provision made for jury review at any stage in the proceedings. So please understand that we're not up here trying to say, you know, that we get this unfettered license to pollute, as I think the Sierra Club brief says, or that we're trying to dismantle the administrative state, or even that we are challenging the power in this instance of the state to assess in the first instance. The sole complaint is narrow, is that there's no jury review available, and in this state, the two are accommodated. You can have administrative adjudication in the first instance so long as you accommodate it with jury review. And that's what this case states, and it is unique. Understand that that is unique because, unlike the feds, where it's absolute, unlike the feds, where the Seventh Amendment right can give way to the police power, in this state, where it is absolutely extinguished in a statute like this, it cannot be not, it cannot, and it's void.
Any other questions?
Does it follow that there is no right to a jury to review a denial of a permit?
No. No, it does not. And this is another argument I think that's being made is that, you know, where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line? The line drawn is not hard. You only get the jury review of the matter to which the right attaches. Jury trial does not attach, has never been held attached, and explicitly does not attach to denial of a permit. We are not suggesting that if one of our members gets a permit denied, that he gets jury review of that. It's stuck with substantial evidence. We'd love to have jury review, but we don't have the right because the Constitution does not guarantee it.
Isn't it a strange situation, though, that no jury review of a total denial of a right to discharge, but if you're granted that right and then are accused of violating it, you get a jury? That's the rule that you say the Constitution...
It is ironic. It is ironic. But it is not conceptually incorrect. And the problem I have with their argument is that, you know, this is a more... Isn't that more financially important? It may be. It may be. But you don't say, because here's a right here's something which may be more financially important to which you don't get jury trial, that you also don't get it here. In other words, they're different inquiries, and you have to split them out. If we don't have the right to jury trial to this, we don't get it. If we do have it to this, we do. It's that simple.
In the regulatory process, the issue of permit, denial of the permit does not require jury review, according to your argument. Would a cancellation or withdrawal of that permit as a penalty require a jury review? We've been talking in terms of monetary penalties, so it would not impede the regulatory process, is what you're saying.
What I'm saying is
only
that
when monetary penalties are imposed.
That is the only one to which I'm aware at this point the right to jury trial attaches. And in fact, there are cases which have already held that cancellation or withdrawal of a permit being inherently administrative do not get your right to jury trial. On the other hand, when you're talking about civil penalties, not only is that not inherently administrative, understand that for 16 years before these amendments went in place, they were done by juries, and in fact still are. The state at this point gets a choice. It can either pursue it in district court, where you get a right to jury trial, or at its pleasure, an administrative agency where you do not. So again, we are not, you know, arguing...
Even though the impact might be much more severe and much greater to have a permit suspended or canceled entirely, or have additional conditions imposed upon it.
Regulatory process than a
monetary penalty.
Right. Again, I mean, I would love to argue to you that our members would have the right to appeal that to a jury, but they don't. They don't. And the reason they don't is because the right is not attached to that. But as to the thing it does attach to, and it unquestionably does with the state is seeking civil penalties, where it does attach, they are absolutely required to get it. And the case that really indicates this, and I am out of time, is White versus White. And there, the adjudication of insanity, historically performed by juries, and to which the right attached, was assigned to a six-member panel of physicians. And the long and short of it was, this court says, well, does the right attach? Yes. And then it says, simply, a commission is not a jury. In this case, an administrative agency is not a jury. It's indistinguishable. If the right attaches to the nature of the action, it's absolutely guaranteed in this state, unlike under the federal system in these four other states.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Counsel.
You have 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal. Court is ready to hear oral argument from Appellee.
Yes, please, the court.
May it please the court. I am Nancy Lynch, Chief of the Environmental Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office. With me today at council table are Mary Kelly, attorney for Intervenor Sierra Club, and Doug Karoom, attorney for Intervenor League of Women Voters. Because of the great importance of this case to the state of Texas, interveners have deferred to the state to make the entire oral argument. They do want the court to know, however, that they are available and prepared to answer any questions that the court may have about their respective positions.
If it's so important, why does the state waive standing?
In a nutshell, the state determined at the trial court level to its satisfaction that this association could prove standing, and decided that in this case it would be better to answer the questions raised by these challenges in one case rather than to face the same challenge in 50 or 100 individual appeals of administrative orders.
Counsel, could parties who in effect wanted an impermissible advisory opinion from this court collusively confer standing by waiving that issue?
I suppose there is always the possibility for an attempt at abuse. I have confidence in the court that it would see through that.
So you think we have, we can determine that issue on our own motion, and it's fundamental to the issue of whether or not we ought to hear a case where the parties might otherwise appear to have waived the issue of standing?
Well, quite frankly, I thought that was the law before the traffic industrial lien case. But after that case, it was my impression, as the Association of Business impression, that it is no longer the law.
What kind of attack against the state statutes or regulations could the Texas Association of Business not have standing to bring?
I think that there is a narrow window when they are threatened with enforcement by a state statute in which they have to bring their attack. I believe that they came through that narrow window in this case, but would not always be able to do that.
Surely they would do it as to workers' compensation, which has already been mentioned.
That may be so. I don't
know. Taxes which affected their business.
That is similar to a very early case by this court, I believe, Cobb v. Harrington, where a similar thing did occur.
That's labor regulations or statutes.
Probably so.
It's hard to think of something that they couldn't attack on behalf of their members. Kind of a roving ombudsman.
It's frightening when
you
put it that way.
Against state statutes. Could keep you in a lot of business over the years.
Is it only their members who are bound, or is it all people who are similarly situated?
Well, I believe it's all people who are similarly situated if the issues that would arise in their case would be the same issues. If someone can raise an as-applied sort of challenge, then it might be a different result. But I think this case will determine the facial validity of these statutes if it reaches the merits.
Since we have four briefs on this matter and all four parties agree on it, could I focus your attention on the merits for a moment?
Please.
How do you distinguish, for purposes of the necessity of a jury trial, any administrative action for a civil penalty from what the state or other governmental entity would have done in 1870 without the administrative provisions in seeking redress through an action for a common law nuisance?
Well, the primary difference in this regulatory scheme is that the state can act much sooner. The state does not have to wait for the creation of a public nuisance. A public nuisance requires a showing of injury to a large number of the public. Actions under these environmental statutes can occur at the first violation of a statute, and that violation could be as simple, seemingly simple, a matter as a record-keeping violation. Record-keeping violations are serious. One type of record that is kept is a record of where you dispose of your hazardous waste and how it travels from one place to another. So keeping that record is very serious, but never keeping that record would never rise to the level of a public nuisance. Public nuisance also survives as far as the common law cause of action is concerned. And at times, in fact, in a case that I handled several years ago, I filed a public law, common public nuisance, common law action where two agencies who might have been involved said they really didn't have jurisdiction, they didn't think, because the actions that had taken place lawfully under the statute, but it had created a public nuisance.
Well, I understand that that action still exists. If the legislature were to prescribe that the consideration of a public nuisance was to be done by the Air Control Board or the Water Board, certainly a jury couldn't be denied, could it?
I think it can.
For a nuisance?
Well, you picked on an interesting example, because actually the Air Control Board statute makes creating a nuisance a violation. Certainly in the application of that statute, I think that the legislature has lawfully delegated to the agency the ability to make that determination without a jury trial. I think a critical factor that appellants attempt to disregard is what forum is designated to determine. I submit that Credit Bureau only determined that in an action in district court for civil penalties, must there be a jury trial.
So if the state wanted to say that the failure to pay any claim that the state had by way of contract or purchase order was a violation of some state statute, they could remove that for jury trial, and they would no longer have to sue for collection of monies in ordinary course. They could just have a little administrative agency.
My suggestion is that the court follow the federal precedent, and I don't believe it is a frivolous distinction to make between public and private rights. And I submit that the environmental regulatory schemes that are at issue here clearly involve public rights, and their adjudication may be assigned to an administrative forum. I don't know that the rights that you just described would be considered private, but there are certainly a great deal more nearly private rights. And according to the U.S. Supreme Court, the limit on this doctrine of assigning things to administrative agencies is where private rights are implicated, and they specifically mention contracts.
Well, to give a little closer example, state could set up an agency under your theory to determine DTBA violations alleged by the state and then impose civil fines and penalties on.
Well, I think that the underlying violations in DTPA actions are also primarily based on private rights and involve money transactions between private individuals and businesses, perhaps.
And that would go for violations of the antitrust laws and violation of the state securities laws, too. Those are primarily private.
It's a little hard to make a decision, particularly in the antitrust area, because I think the antitrust statutes were designed to protect the public in many instances. The federal courts also seem to have a little bit of difficulty in drawing this distinction, and I think deal with it on a case-by-case basis.
Well, I thought your DTPA function was to protect the public, and that it was really left. That was the general reason why the Attorney General would bring an action.
I think that
the public was being defrauded, and private rights and damages for private violation were essentially left to private enforcement.
The Attorney General becomes involved when a large number of people are potentially injured by fraudulent practices or practices that violate that act.
Do you think we have to limit or overrule White versus White in order to reach the result you urge?
No, I don't. I think the distinction, once again, is forum. That's the operative distinction. I don't think any Texas cases need to be overruled to reach the result we are.
Let me again focus your attention on pollution. I'm a polluter, an air polluter, in 1876, and the state decides that it's going to bring common law nuisance action against me. I get a right to a jury, right?
Yeah.
And we're in 1991, and the state decides that it can bring an action against me because I'm a common law nuisance as an air polluter, but instead of bringing it as a common law nuisance action, which it has the right to do, it chooses to come under the provision that you referred me to earlier, under the Air Control Board, and to cite me for a violation of the provisions that you referred to that make certain kind of discharges, I suppose, a common law nuisance, and they're going to fine me. Why is it that the legislature, through this process, can deny me the right to a jury for the same kind of offense that I would have had a right to a jury in 1876 for?
Well, you look to rights and remedies, and the remedies at common law were simply for abatement. The state could have the pollution stopped. There was no provision for civil monetary penalties. Under the statute, there is such a provision, so the remedies are different.
If the state wants to stop it, they still have to go to a district court and seek a factual resolution. But if they merely want to fine it for each day of its continuance, they can go through the administrative.
Actually, the state has the absolute power to issue an administrative injunction against whoever is creating the pollution, and that is not challenged. That function is not challenged by the Texas Association of Businesses. Now, they can't throw anybody in jail, you know, hold anybody in contempt for violating that order. Then it comes to the Attorney General's office to be enforced in court.
Counsel, if the state has the authority to regulate those things which affect the public interest, I think the other side has conceded that they do. They never. In their opening statements, we're not questioning the right of the state to regulate these particular activities. And in the course of that regulation, have the constitutional lawful authority to grant or deny, condition, or suspend permits to operate. Does an affected entity waive its common law right to your review in cases where monetary penalties are possible by virtue of voluntarily engaging in that regulatory process, that is, engaging in a regulated activity?
Right. I certainly think that there are cases of the court primarily involving business licenses being revoked.
In other words, they want to engage in this business. This is a regulated industry, right, because it affects the public interest. They seek a permit. They enter into that process. Then when it comes to the regulatory authority itself, even the imposition of monetary penalties, you're saying that they waive any common law right they might have if they operated outside of the process. If they didn't attempt to seek a permit, certainly I think the law, the state would be well within its authority to come in and shut them down or impose penalties on them that were not part of the regulatory process itself. But then, in that case, they could go get them a court trial.
I think your analysis could be used, yes. And I think you made a very good point a while ago about how administrative penalties are a much less harsh remedy than a license revocation. In fact, a license revocation in the context of environmental permits is really pretty much an illusory remedy when you're dealing with permits that so much affect the public welfare. We can't very well revoke the City of Austin's license to operate sewage treatment plants.
As a practical matter, outside of an entity like, for instance, the City of Austin, disposing of waste. There are a number of other industries, petrochemical industries and what have you out there who've promulgated a different kind of waste. If a regulatory agency did not have the authority to impose monetary penalties, they could only suspend or cancel or withdraw a permit as a regulatory matter, and had to await the jury process before other sanctions could be imposed. Do you suspect that some of these agencies might suspend some of these permits and suspend some of these operations pending the outcome of these jury processes, which might be a matter of years in some cases?
It would probably take a few years. The agencies have been very loath to suspend those operating permits, partly out of concern for the economic well-being of the state and the people who work in those plants. You close a plant that employs 100 people.
You devastate a portion of the economy.
That's right.
But you stop the pollution.
That's
Mr.
right,
Alexander
too.
Mr. Alexander placed considerable emphasis on Article 1, Section 29 of the Texas Constitution in his analysis of why jury trials are required. Why isn't that persuasive?
Well, if I might, let me quote from Braden's treatise on the Texas Constitution in regard to Article 1, Section 29. Presumably, Section 29 was designed as a closing flourish to emphasize the importance of the Bill of Rights. Unfortunately, it is not clear just what it means, and one is left with the suspicion that despite the apparently strong language, it means nothing at all. Section 29 has been cited in relatively few cases, and in them, the decision typically turned on another section of the Bill of Rights cited with Section 29. So I would submit that it really doesn't add that much to the underlying rights. I think that, I believe it was Justice Doggett's point a while ago that Credit Bureau relied on federal precedent is an excellent point. And I believe that this court would be well advised to study those federal precedents. Atlas Roofing Company versus the Occupational Safety and Health Act, or Review Board, is the one that really goes into this question in detail. And then the case cited by the PAB this morning explained somewhat what they were doing in the Atlas Roofing case, and makes it clear that public right versus private right distinction is a significant and important one. Justice Pope also acknowledged in that case that the Seventh Amendment and the Texas Constitution right to jury trial provisions were very similar in the way they were approached and construed. In the Atlas Roofing case, petitioners made precisely the same argument that TAB is making here, and that is that a suit in federal court by the government for civil penalties for the violation of a statute is a suit for a money judgment requiring a jury trial. And the court's holding was that where a statute has created new public rights, and these statutes all do, that the government enforces in its sovereign capacity, that the government can assign the adjudication of those rights to an administrative agency with which a jury would be incompatible.
So it could assign wrongful death cases to an agency?
Well, again, the court limited its holding and said that this only involves public rights, that the wholly private tort, contract, and property cases are not implicated by that holding.
Why is OSHA more likely to be public rights than some of the remedies we were discussing a few minutes ago?
Well, the Congress determined that public safety was not adequately protected by the common law rights that were available to the individual worker.
Isn't much of OSHA just related with regulations that will protect the workers there at the plant?
It is directed largely toward safety standards. And one of the things that was created in that regulatory system was a violation if one of those safety standards was not met.
This OSHA public-private distinction that you refer to seems very slippery to me. And I have a hard time understanding why that would be public and some of the other things that we've mentioned.
It is a little slippery.
DTPA, antitrust might possibly be private.
And I think it's a matter of fine line drawing.
Well, can the Congress just declare it to be one or the other, and that's an end to the inquiry?
I think the court may consider that, but I don't think the court would necessarily consider that dispositive of the issue.
If DTPA, antitrust, and security civil fines might not be imposed by a state agency, what else might be under existing law?
Well, certainly the licensing of professions that are licensed for the public health, safety, and welfare would be one area where public rights would be highly implicated.
And fines and penalties could be imposed by those agencies.
Yes. The right to jury trial in Texas is not absolute. It certainly is broader than it is in many other jurisdictions. And the fact that a jury is allowed in cases in equity in Texas is the primary distinction between Texas and those other jurisdictions. But there are a lot of adversary proceedings where there is no right to jury trial, such as civil contempt proceedings, election contests, habeas corpus proceedings, proceedings for the custody of a minor child, and appeals and administrative proceedings. One of the reasons that the legislature has assigned administrative penalty functions to agencies is because of the expertise that agencies have. That expertise is very helpful in assessing the harm that is caused by the violation of a particular statute or regulation. The legislature has not, however, delegated these responsibilities without criteria. The standards that an agency must use and the criteria that an agency must look at are very specifically set out in all of the acts that are being challenged today. I would submit that where a jury acts as a check and balance on the discretion of a district court judge, that the legislature has performed that check and balance function with the agencies by tightly constraining the discretion that they have in the assessment of administrative penalties. The state requests that the court affirm the trial court and hold that these statutes are constitutional and do not violate the right to jury trial.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I want to go directly to the question asked by Justice Doggett concerning Article 1, Section 29. The position taken by the state is that that provision is meaningless, and certainly that is what the commentary they cite say. It is not meaningless, and I'd like to cite at this point two companion cases by this court which plainly demonstrate that it's not. And again, they're not in any of the briefs, but we'll have it in the transcript. The first one is Travelers case. It's 76 Southwest 2nd, 1007. And the second is Langever, L-A-N-G-E-V-E-R, 76 Southwest 2nd, 1025. those cases both address Article 1, Section 29. In addressing it, they recognize that it operates as an absolute constraint on the exercise of police power by the legislature in cases where a statute directly impacts a right guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, and which is what we're dealing with here. In fact, here we're not just dealing with an impact, and that's what they were talking about there. We are dealing with an absolute extinguishment of a right in the cases of administrative adjudication. They go so far as to say that even where the legislature is lawfully enacting these laws to implement the Constitution, if it runs up against the Bill of Rights, it is void, and that's the term that they use. They further point out in Travelers, because they're grappling with the fact there that the feds seem to be taking a different approach, that the federal government has no similar provision to Article 1, Section 29. So it does have meaning here, and that is the meaning, and that is the fundamental distinction between the Texas approach and the U.S. approach. The U.S. approach is that at some point, the police power, even in the case of a direct conflict, not an incidental one, but direct conflict, the police power is supreme. In Texas, we take a fundamentally different approach. And in the case of a direct conflict between the police power and a right guaranteed by the Bill of Rights is supreme. And that is the distinction. And it's that fundamental, and it is that simple. Now, I want to turn to this whole idea of public rights versus private rights. You were talking about being a slippery slope. It is. And the reason it is the Grand Financiera, 1989 case, points out that it is expansive. It is not narrow. It is incredibly expansive. And in fact, they say it is more expansive than Atlas Roofing, which is the first one to grapple with it in terms of the Seventh Amendment right. Again, you will not find any case in Texas discussing the right to jury trial which grapples with this public versus private distinction. And the reason is we don't get to that point. We don't get to that point because once we cross the bridge of finding that the right attaches, that is the end of the inquiry, and that, again, is the fundamental distinction between our approach and theirs, and it's unique. In this, I mean, we may end up being the only state to so hold, and that is because of this decision we crossed the bridge in our Constitution of saying that the Bill of Rights is always supreme and is a direct constraint upon the power of the legislature in the case of a direct conflict as we have here.
Counsel?
Yes.
I'd like for you to respond essentially to the question I posed to Ms. Lynch a few moments ago. I think in your opening statements you stated that unquestionably the state has the authority to institute regulatory devices to protect those things affecting the public interest. Someone could come in and get an injunction against you for a public nuisance without a jury, or other remedies at law without a jury, then the state has the authority inherently to prevent that kind of thing from occurring through a regulatory process. When one voluntarily enters into that regulatory process, is it possible that one waives what normally would be a common law right to a jury for the institution of penalties? If they can submit themselves to the greater penalty, and that is a total cessation of their operations by entering into that process, why not? Why can they not waive a lesser penalty, which is the imposition of monetary penalties in lieu of suspension, cancellation, and what have you?
Okay. And I see the red light's gone on, but let me grapple with that. First off, understand that we're not just talking about situations in which people voluntarily enter into the administrative process.
If you didn't voluntarily enter into the process and you attempt to operate, you'd be enjoined. You wouldn't have a jury there.
Okay, well, in fact, and let me address this. Understand, this case is focusing on the civil penalty aspect to which the right to jury trial plainly attaches. We have not focused on the injunction. And in fact, when you brought up the issue of injunction, it caught me a little bit by surprise because what I was talking about in terms of concessions.
You'd be enjoined without a jury, but if you want damages, you've got to go to a jury.
No. Actually, in this state, that's not true. I mean, you can be temporarily enjoined, but in this state, the remedy of injunction, there's a right to jury trial that attaches. It does attach, and which, again, makes this state unique, almost, among all states. We're unique on jury trial. I mean, so what I'm suggesting to you is that, no, that is not something that's waivable. This is a statute which empowers the state to assess civil penalties against a business whether or not it has voluntarily or involuntarily entered into anything. And because that is a right, the right to a jury trial attaches to that thing, it is absolutely protected. And that's what these cases, Travelers, Langever, and White v. White, which cannot be distinguished, plainly established. The word attaches, it's absolute. In case of direct conflict. And I see I'm out of time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.